You know that feeling. You finish a meticulous clearing session on stage, right? The hall is totally quiet.
Oh yeah, every player knows this exact moment.
Right. So you've tapped around every single lug and they perfectly match. Your roll is dead centered and the pitch is holding beautifully steady at soft dynamics. You are completely locked in.
Yep, you feel invincible.
Exactly. But then, the concert actually starts. And the moment you lay into a fortissimo, the drum suddenly shimmers with this weird dissonance.
It just totally betrays you.
It really does. Or maybe you get to the third measure of a massive passage and the pitch just starts to drift away from the orchestra. So you reach down, you desperately tweak a tuning rod, which, maybe helps a little bit, but it doesn't fix it completely.
Yeah.
So what went wrong? Like, are you losing your ear or is your technique failing you under pressure?
It is incredibly frustrating for any serious student or professional player, but I can assure you the answer is neither. It's actually just the inescapable physics of the instrument you're sitting behind.
Okay, let's unpack this because today's deep dive takes a stack of comprehensive acoustic and psychoacoustic research to find out exactly why your drum feels like it's fighting you.
And spoiler alert, your timpani will actually never be mathematically in tune.
Never. And we're going to explore why you need to stop fighting that reality and, start embracing it. Our mission today is to shift your entire paradigm away from the impossible chase for perfect harmonicity and into the art of managed harmonicity.
Exactly. Because the pitch you hear on a timpano is this deeply complex compromise between a circular membrane, the physics of a copper bowl, the hardware, and, well, your own human ear.
It's a lot of variables, so where do we even begin?
Well, to even begin managing a timpani's pitch, we have to look at why the drum naturally resists true pitch in the first place. Like, think about a violin string or an organ pipe.
Sure, the classic example is a perfect pitch.
Right. Those instruments produce what we call true harmonic pitch. The sound they create is built on whole number integer multiples of a fundamental frequency. It's a clean, simple mathematical ladder, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And as listeners, our brains absolutely love that clean mathematical ladder. We crave it,
Oh,
right?
I completely rely on it. The human brain uses that ordered spectrum to easily resolve pitch. It's actually the psychoacoustic basis of something called the missing fundamental effect.
No, I've heard of this. It's when your brain basically hallucinates the lowest note, right?
Yeah, pretty much. If you hear a sound where that clean mathematical ladder of upper partials is present, but the lowest foundational note is completely missing or incredibly weak, your brain just fills in the blank.
That is wild.
It really is. It calculates the math of the overtones and says, oh, the fundamental note must be a C. But a timpani membrane completely defies this logic.
Right, because trying to get a two-dimensional circular membrane to sing a pure harmonic note like a violin string is, well, it's like asking a trampoline to bounce perfectly straight up and down in every spot at once. It just wants to wobble.
That is a great analogy. It just wants to wobble in 100 different directions. And that wobble is governed by something called Bessel function behavior, rather than those simple integers we see in a string.
Bessel functions. Okay, so how should we visualize that?
So think of tossing a rock into a pond. You get perfect concentric rings expanding outward, right?
Right, the ripples.
Exactly. Now imagine you also slice that pond like a pizza into wedges. Bessel functions describe how a circular membrane vibrates. Using a combination of those circular rings, which acousticians call nodal circles, and those pizza slices or nodal diameters.
Okay, so the drum head is basically rippling in these complex geometric patches.
Yes, precisely. This means the raw physics of a drum head is inherently inharmonic before you even pick up a mallet. And if we look at the lowest mode of the drum, what they label mode 01, meaning zero diameters, and one circle near the edge, it actually radiates sound very efficiently.
So the entire head just moves up and down together.
It does, yes, but that movement dies away almost instantly.
Ah, so that's the initial thump you get when the mallet first makes contact.
Exactly. It's powerful, but it is totally useless for holding a pitch. It gives you the attack, but not the sustained musical note.
Right, you can't sing a thump.
Exactly. The pitch you actually hear and rely on is anchored by higher modes. The most important one is mode 1-1.
Mode 1-1. What does the 1-1 mean in this case?
So the first one means there is one nodal diameter, basically a line straight across the middle of the drum that doesn't move at all. And the second one is one nodal circle. This creates a seesaw motion where opposite sides of the drum head are moving in opposite directions.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm completely following this. The membrane itself inherently wants to be inharmonic, and the fundamental up and down thump isn't even the pitch we ultimately hear.
That's right. Your ear uses that seesaw mode as its perceptual anchor.
So how do we get a recognizable, sustained note out of this wobbly trampoline at all?
Well, we enclose it. This is where the kettle, or the bowl of the timpano, steps in. The enclosed air inside that bowl fundamentally shifts the behavior of the membrane's modes.
So the air acts like a cushion.
More like a pneumatic spring.
Mm-hmm.
When the drum head pushes down, the air inside has nowhere to go. You know, it compresses and it pushes back.
Oh, I see.
This air loading selectively slows down certain lower modes of the membrane, bending those chaotic ripples much closer to harmonic relationships. Studies actually show that this air spring brings the ratios of several important modes to approach a 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 relationship.
Approaching it, but you know, as we know, approaching a destination is not the same as arriving at it.
Not at all. Close to harmonic is definitively not harmonic.
No, come on.
We can see this really clearly in Arthur Benet's famous acoustic measurements of a Dresden timpano.
Oh, right, where he measured the deviations in cents.
Yes, where 1 cent is just 1/100th of a semitone.
Yep.
So mode 3-1, which has 3 slice lines across the head, is essentially perfect, 0 cents off.
Okay, that sounds promising.
It does, but then mode 2-1 is 3.2 cents sharp. And as you climb higher up the overtone ladder, it completely falls apart. Mode 5-1 is 12.1 cents flat, and mode 6-1 is nearly 19 cents flat.
Wait, 19 cents? That's roughly a quarter of a semitone flat. For a professional player, I mean, that is a massive, highly noticeable deviation.
Oh, absolutely. And these growing deviations are exactly what prevent the timpano from ever being a perfect harmonic oscillator. You just cannot eliminate them. But the bowl is actually crucial for another somewhat surprising reason.
No, what's that?
There are these 3 incredible studies by Helmut Fleischer and Hugo Fassel from the University of Munich. They used laser vibrometry to measure exactly where the sound of a timpani actually comes from.
Laser vibrometry. Sounds very sci-fi. What did they find?
They proved that the dominant sound radiation comes entirely from the preferred modes of the membrane. The kettle acts purely as a passive radiator and a fine tuner of those frequencies via that air spring we just talked about.
Wait, hold on. I genuinely struggle with this concept every time I read it.
That throws a lot of people off.
Yeah, because I always assumed the bowl was basically a giant acoustic megaphone. You're telling me this massive, beautiful, hammered copper kettle isn't projecting the sound to the back of the hall?
Nope. It's completely counterintuitive, but the laser vibrometry confirmed it beyond a doubt. All the sound originates exclusively from the head.
Then what is the bowl actually doing? Just sitting there looking pretty.
Well, the bowl itself does not contribute constructively to the acoustic output. In fact, the physical shape of the kettle is acoustically unimportant. It's actually the volume of the air trapped inside that matters. The copper is just a very stiff, reflective container for the pneumatic spring.
Wow, that completely upends how most of us picture the instrument working.
It really does. And you have to be careful, too, because kettle and frame resonances can actually work against you. They can create what acousticians call dead frequencies.
Dead frequencies. That sounds ominous.
It's a very real problem. These are narrow acoustic bands where the vibrational energy of the drum head hits a sympathetic resonance in the frame or bowl. Instead of turning into sound, that energy gets converted into heat.
It turns into heat.
Yeah, and it instantly kills the sustain of certain partials in specific pitch ranges.
That is mind-blowing. The bowl isn't a megaphone at all. It's a passive air spring trying to tame the wobbling trampoline, and occasionally it just steals your sound as heat.
That's a perfect summary, honestly.
So if the bowl just sets this very delicate, highly compromised stage, what happens when we introduce a mallet? Like, how does the player's physical interaction alter this mathematics?
Well, the player actually controls the strike point. Where you hit the head dictates which of those modes are allowed to live and which are immediately suppressed.
So if you strike dead in the center of the drum, what happens?
You forcefully excite mode 0-1.
The giant up and down thump, which we already established is totally unhelpful for pitch.
Exactly. But when you move your mallet to the normal playing zone,
mm-hmm.
you know, off-center, roughly 3 to 5 inches in from the rim, you specifically bypass that thump. Striking there physically suppresses the center from moving up and down.
And I'm guessing that excites the pitch modes.
Spot on.
Yeah.
It strongly excites the pitch-bearing modes, like that seesaw mode 1-1.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because stick placement isn't just a matter of tone color or articulation like we're so often taught in school.
No, not at all.
It is literally an act of real-time acoustic filtering. You are selectively turning on and off different mathematical modes of the drum based purely on the geography of your hands.
That is exactly right. And taking that a step further, it explains the physics behind mallet choice and stroke velocity, too. Well, when you use a harder mallet or execute a faster, more violent stroke, you excite more of the head's upper partials. You are actively exposing the instability of the system, like that 19-cent flat mode 6-1.
Oh, so hitting it hard brings out the bad math.
Yeah, a softer mallet, on the other hand, physically stays on the head just a millisecond longer. That contact dampens those highest, flattest partials.
So it hides the instability.
It blends the sound and hides the mathematical instability, yeah. But the trade-off is that it might obscure the immediate pitch center. You are constantly negotiating this compromise stroke by stroke.
And if we're relying so heavily on our mallets to filter out bad mathematics, the actual material we're hitting must play a massive role. I mean, every stroke interacts with the canvas itself.
Oh, materials, everything. Whether you use plastic or calfskin, you are trading one set of compromises for another.
Right. So let's look at synthetic heads first, your standard PET film or Mylar, because a lot of players treat these as perfectly neutral, sterile sheets of plastic.
Oh, they are anything but neutral. Synthetic heads carry a deep structural history. Just think about how they are made.
Okay, they're manufactured in a factory.
Right, and the plastic is subjected to biaxial orientation. It's heated and pulled in two different directions at the factory to give it strength. That whole process freezes a molecular memory into the film.
A molecular memory, so it wants to pull back.
Exactly. And add to that how it was stretched onto the hoop, the processing heat, and its long-term tension history once it's actually on your drum.
Wow, so even leaving the pedal engaged overnight matters.
Huge factor. If
Yeah.
you have a slightly uneven tuck, a distorted insert, or even just bearing edge crease fatigue from leaving that pedal engaged, that history is permanently baked into the film.
So the plastic is constantly trying to return to its previous shape, fighting your tuning rods in the process. That completely explains why a head can look perfectly clean and the thickness gauge can read correct, but the modal cooperation is just totally disturbed.
Yes, it creates a structural bias.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of the aisle, you have natural skinheads.
Which are visually stunning and have this incredible depth of sound, but they're biologically completely uneven.
Because it's an animal product, yeah. They have variations in thickness, in density. I mean, they literally have a stiffer backbone running straight through the middle of the skin.
And for anyone who has ever played calfskin, you know they are intensely sensitive to humidity.
Oh, it's a nightmare sometimes.
Right. A damp concert hall causes them to absorb moisture, lose tension, and just drop in pitch mid-performance. So let me ask you this. If I'm a professional using synthetic heads specifically to avoid the humidity nightmare of calfskin, am I really just trading biological variability for tension memory variability?
That is the ultimate trade-off, yes.
Yeah.
You haven't escaped the compromise at all. You've
Yeah.
just moved you to a different set of physical laws.
That's a little depressing, but good to know.
Well, skinheads are alive with organic variability. Synthetic heads are manufactured for consistency, but acquire a structural tension history that dictates how they vibrate. Neither material gives you perfect harmonic pitch.
Which brings us to the mechanical reality of the instrument holding that material. Because frankly, even if you possessed a mathematically perfect head and you struck it in the mathematically perfect spot, it will all fall apart if the hardware holding it isn't cooperating.
The research makes this incredibly clear. The mechanical system is the acoustical system.
Right, they aren't separate.
The drum must permit the head to behave. If you have a bowl that is even a fraction of an inch out of round, a warped counter hoop, or a bearing edge that binds, you are going to force asymmetrical tension into the membrane.
I always try to visualize this like a rusted pulley system, you know?
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, like you're pulling hard on your end of the rope, which is you turning the tuning rod, but the rope is catching on a rusted wheel, where's the bearing edge of the drum? You can apply all the tension you want at the lug, but the force never actually reaches the center of the drum head because it gets stuck on the edge.
Exactly. That friction is the source of endless frustration for players
Yeah.
because it usually results in what we call a false clear.
A false clear. Tell me about that.
It's when the drum seems perfectly cleared at one specific pitch during a quiet stage test. But the moment you play it under actual musical conditions, the violent vibration breaks that friction slightly.
Oh, so the tension suddenly shifts.
Right, and the note shimmers or drifts.
Which completely shatters one of the biggest illusions in timpani tuning, The idea that equal rod adjustment equals equal membrane tension.
It is a very dangerous illusion to rely on. A tension rod only applies force at a single, isolated point on the perimeter. But the membrane responds as a massive, continuous surface.
It's like trying to smooth out a bedsheet on a lumpy mattress.
Exactly. Between the rod you are turning and the center of the head, you are fighting that bearing edge friction, hoop geometry, local stretching, and the material's memory.
So matching the lugs by tapping near them?
Is a useful starting point, sure, but it is woefully incomplete. The drum can sound perfectly matched at the lugs and still fail completely as a full, unified vibrating membrane.
So how do we fix this? The sources recommend something called the 4.2-channel check. And for the serious players listening, this is a crucial practical takeaway.
It really is. You don't just tap around the edge in a circle. You test the primary playing channel, meaning the specific axis where your mallets will actually strike the drum against the secondary orthogonal channel, which is exactly 90 degrees away.
So you physically move your body or your mallets over to that 90-degree axis to check it.
Yes, physically move. By comparing those two cross-sections of the drum, you aren't just matching lugs. You're asking a fundamental acoustic question. Does the whole head behave as one unified membrane?
And you have to ask that question across the drum's entire range, right? Because a timpano is not a piano. It's not tempered for one fixed note.
Correct. As you move the pedal, the head tension changes, the firmness of the air spring changes, and the relationships between all those Bessel function modes shift around.
So a head that behaves perfectly as one unified membrane for a low F might be completely unstable and mathematically chaotic an octave higher.
Very often, yes. You must tune for a working compromise across the usable range of the instrument.
And dynamics play into this just as much as range. I mean, a quiet, cautious test tap only excites a tiny, localized area of the head.
Exactly. It doesn't tell the whole story.
But a fortissimo stroke excites the whole membrane and reveals all those tension asymmetries that we're basically hiding in the dark. So what does this all mean? It means players need to stop tuning for a cautious, quiet test tap in an empty hall and start tempering the drum for the actual violent reality of a live performance.
Spot on. And we also have to consider the environment of that live performance. Because even if your drum is mechanically balanced for a fortissimo stroke, it still has to survive the concert hall and the perception of the human brain.
The room itself literally becomes part of the instrument.
The room dictates the physics. Temperature and humidity fundamentally change the density of the air, which changes the speed of sound.
Which goes right back to the air spring inside the kettle.
Yes. This alters how the pneumatic air spring inside the bowl interacts with the head. A drum that was perfectly balanced in a dry 70-degree room will behave completely differently on a humid 85-degree stage.
So acclimating your drums to the performance space is absolutely necessary, not just some superstitious ritual.
It is basic physics.
And then there is the brain. We talked earlier about the missing fundamental effect, where our brain just fills in the gaps of a pitch.
Right, the brain's autocorrect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If a timpani's upper partials are inherently slightly out of tune, like remember that 19-cent flat mode 6-1 we discussed, the ear can be easily misled by that shimmer?
Totally. Which means tempering a timpani is actually an act of highly advanced ear training. You have to learn to listen through the initial attack.
Right. Ignore the thump.
Ignore the thump. Listen through that inharmonic shimmer of the upper partials and focus your brain purely on the sustained pitch center of mode 1-1.
Which is exactly why relying completely on technology can be a massive trap.
Yeah.
Like, are electronic tuners giving serious students a false sense of security?
I believe they often do, yes.
I mean, are players staring at a green light on a screen instead of listening to the actual complex behavior of the membrane? Because an electronic tuner is just measuring local mechanical conditions or isolated frequencies?
Exactly. It has no way to evaluate if the primary and orthogonal channels agree or if the drum is actually musically centered.
Tools are servants to the ear, not the master.
Beautifully said. A tuner cannot tell you if the pitch holds through the decay in a humid hall. Only an experienced ear, actively engaging with the missing fundamental effect, can do that.
So, to pull all of these physical, mechanical, and psychoacoustic realities together, what is the final philosophy for the modern timpanist? It seems like we have to stop expecting mathematical perfection and just start managing cooperation.
Yes. When you are sitting behind the drums, you have to constantly ask musical questions. Does the tone speak immediately? Is it stable through the decay? Do your loud strokes and your soft strokes agree on the exact same pitch center?
So the best timpani pitch is not mathematically pure.
Not at all. It is what we should really call organized in harmonicity.
Organized in harmonicity. I love that.
When everything cooperates, you know, when the bezel modes align just enough thanks to the air spring, when the hardware allows the head to move past its structural memory, when the room supports the sound, and the player listens critically, the result is profoundly convincing.
Even if it isn't physically true by a physicist's rigid standard.
Exactly. It is a massive, resonant, beautiful pitch.
It is the ultimate managed acoustic compromise. And, you know, it leaves us with one final lingering thought for you to ponder the next time you finish a meticulous clearing session on stage.
Oh, what's that?
Well, if a timpani's perfect pitch is actually just a highly managed acoustic compromise, and your brain is actively helping to construct that pitch center via the missing fundamental effect by filling in the blanks of those enharmonic upper partials, does the true pitch of a timpani actually exist on the physical stage at all? Or does the final perfected instrument only truly exist inside the mind of the listener?